Blog Talk Radio.
It's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen. Welcome you to this week's episode of the John Mack Radio Show, an affiliate of Rapid Talk Radio, carried live each Sunday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Links to previous episodes and the list of upcoming shows are available at my web home, www.johnmack13.com. That's johnmac13.com, www.johnmack13.com. At the same site are links to my radio and TV interviews, podcasts, videos, and links to my series of newspaper columns. The upcoming episodes of this show will include authors and poets, judges, technologists, religious leaders, and other people whom I find interesting, and I hope you will also. My guest next week is attorney, former prosecutor, and author Stan Tribolsky. And on to tonight's guest with a little introductory music.
East side, west side, all around the town. The top bang ring a rosy. London Bridge is falling down. And Mamie O'Rourke, trip to life fantastic on the sidewalks of New York.
The music tells, or even warns the audience, that tonight's guest, Jim Caulfield, is another interesting Inwood alumni, as were Steve McPartland, Jim Casey, and Dan Sheen from earlier shows. If you haven't heard their interviews, by the way, you will find the links to them at the website that I mentioned earlier, under the radio show tab. Jim Caulfield was a few years behind me in Good Shepherd Grammar School, and 1 year behind Jim Casey, both in Good Shepherd and in the Barrytown training of the Wooden Christian Brothers. After 2 years, Jim decided this was not what his vocation was to be, then returned to New York City life, first to LaSalle Academy, and then Fordham University. Along the way, he became interested in flying, took private lessons, and then joined the Air Force ROTC. Upon graduation, he was commissioned an officer, completed flying school, and did two tours in Vietnam. While in the service, he decided that his future would be related to the law, then while in Vietnam, took the LSAT, that's the law school aptitude test. And upon completion of his military service, began law school at Ohio State University. His legal training was the entry point to a career that took him through positions in the FBI, as assistant attorney general in the state of Ohio, as a civil and criminal trial lawyer, back into the Air Force as a judge advocate general attorney, as a federal level relations lawyer, and finally as a federal administrative judge in various jurisdictions throughout the country. Wow. All in one lifetime. We'll cover all this history in depth tonight as we introduce the very interesting and accomplished Jim Caulfield to the John Mack Radio Show audience. Good evening, Jim, and welcome.
Thank you, John. And I did appreciate the musical intro. I'm sure that Jim and the other guys did as well. Wasn't expecting. I'm happy to be here.
Let's go back to the beginning. The other alumni have commented on how their Inwood life was a special preparation for their future lives. Steve McPartland mentioned communication, building friendships, and becoming street smart. Jim Casey mentioned the freedom that Inwood Park provided. Dan Sheehan mentioned of the sports and the camaraderie. And they all mentioned the clergy and the schools. Your turn.
Well, you know, I hate to play the lawyer, but I would probably attach myself to all of those comments. I think they're all part and parcel of growing up in Inwood, as you well know. I think certainly the clergy and the Christian Brothers had a big influence on me. And even though I, as you rightly pointed out in the intro, I declined the invitation to continue the vocation, I never forgot the training. I never forgot the discipline that went with it. And, of course, the rest of it in terms of the neighborhood, in terms of the people, you got a smattering of life that, quite frankly, held you in good stead in all the other things I did, including what you commented on, the streetwise, if you will, factor. Certainly that came into play in more ways than one in my life. And so all of the above. I don't know that they left anything out, to be frank with you.
Do you remember what made you decide at such an early age to be a Christian Brother, and what later made you decide that it was not to be the vocation for you?
You know, John, it's a fascinating question. And if I seem to hedge, it's because even at this ripe old age, I'm not entirely sure. I think I am sure of the fact that I was enamored by their authority, their ability to do the things that they did, both, you know, simultaneously, not only teaching you academically, but, you know, participating in sports with you, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that certainly was a factor. I will also admit, and this is tragic because it's not very religious what I'm about to say, but I suspect there was also an element that I've thought about years later. It was sort of the only avenue open for a young man who was still too young to join the Marines. And I know that may sound silly, but in a fashion, it was a way to go and do another adventure, if that makes sense. So I think it was equal parts of both, if that makes sense to you.
That's a great line.
As far as leaving is concerned, I got to the point where I realized that I was staying more to prove to myself that I could versus that I should. And again, that may not make sense, but that's the best I've ever been able to think, because I've thought about it many times. And my thoughts of Barrytown, which some of your listeners may not know about, that's the junior novitiate as well as the novitiate, and the life that was there has always played an immense part in my life over the years. You mentioned the neighborhood, and certainly that was an equal part. But Barrytown was too, because as I'm sure some of your participants have probably told you, the discipline that was instilled in me there made the military a joke. I mean, we were doing hospital corners on beds and getting up at 5:30 in the morning, eating meals without speaking. The big thrill of the year was one movie a month with two candy bars. And it taught me a discipline of mind and body that, quite frankly, held me in good stead years later in a lot of places I didn't want to be. So, anyway, I don't know if that's a good answer, but it's the best I've been able to muster over these years, and I have thought about it more than a few times.
It is, and it's a good – it's interesting. It's also – you know that we have the monthly Inwood luncheons, and people come from all over to go to that. But I also attend periodically something at Manhattan College, where I'm the only non-ex-Christian brother or Christian brother or spouse of a Christian brother. I go with Jim Casey, and it's a regular discussion on ethical and on the world. And there are many people who are Buddhists now, or the Catholics now, or the brothers now. And the interesting I find is that with all of the divergence of opinion and differing opinions, there's a camaraderie there that none of them are antagonistic. They're all sharing. They're all it's very similar to what we find at our Good Shepherd lunches. That camaraderie from 50 years ago is still there.
Yes, and it's funny because I would go to those, by the way, and to other reunions that they've had more frequently, except for the fact that between the government and life in general, I've never seemed to be closer than, you know, 600-700 miles to New York anymore since I left there. But I did get on occasion, and I think it was 2007, 2008, and got up there. Mike Finnegan was still a Christian brother, another Inwoodite, and Ed Hartman and a bunch of other fellows that I knew from Barrytown were there. And even though some of them had gone on and been in the brothers for 20, 30 years thereafter, and in the case of Mike was still a brother, it was amazing. Despite all those, the passage of all those decades, I felt like we were, you know, back in high school again. So you're right. It's a camaraderie that I think the closest I've ever encountered with it is in the military. It seems to be a similar type thing. But
you know,
you're absolutely correct.
You know, the Mike's no longer with us.
I know. I did. And it's funny because I saw Mike up there and hadn't seen him in decades and decades. And he was still Mike. Great sense of humor, you know, just a super guy, et cetera. And it was heartbreaking when I heard, you know, not only that he died, but how he died. And I know Pete Ballasty and Ed Hartman were two of his best friends, I think. And they helped with a lot of the affairs over there in Jersey in terms of the where he was. And I know they were heartbroken when he died.
Yeah, he was Eddie Hartman, who I run into periodically at the things at Manhattan or at other things. He spends volunteer time down at Lincroft with the older brothers weeks at a time during a year. He's just terrific like that.
Yeah, he is. And but you know that's Eddie. Eddie's been that way since I've known him. He and I were in, my God, I think we started out in the second or third grade together. So I've known him for years, but I didn't keep up with him until recently. And he's the one that invited me to come up and go over there to Jersey when they had the reunion. And I just had a ball. I mean, and I was as I told Eddie at the time, I was the interloper because most of these guys had stayed years and what have you. And but it was amazing. They opened, you know, their arms to me, and it was a great time. It was an absolute great time.
Jim Case is very active in Lincroft too, and he also maintains this mailing list for the ex-brothers, this online mailing list, and they coordinate there.
Yeah, and I'm on that, and Jim is a super guy. I remember him from days up in Barrytown as well, and I know he's a good friend of yours. He's quite a character. He's one hell of a writer like you as well.
Moving on beyond the Christian Brothers, I find it very unusual an Inwood lad would not only be interested in flying, but go off to Teterboro Airport to take flying lessons. How did that come to be? How'd you get back and forth?
Well, first off, it's kind of funny because I picked that up in Barrytown, which is kind of classic, you know. I look back and, you know, how you do things years later, and two of the things I did in life, one the flying and one later the FBI, I couldn't, you know, figure out how. I never had any relatives that did it or anybody, you know, that was related. So, you know, how did it start? And I realized that we had a movie every month up at Barrytown. And at the end of the movie, they frequently had, you remember how they used to have in the movies, the trailers at the end? You know, something.
Sure.
Well, in any event, this one time, and I think the movie, believe it or not, was Quo Vadis, okay? It was never first run, but they were usually only a year or two old at that time, which dates me, obviously. But at the end of it, they had the Thunderbirds. I don't know if you're familiar with them. That's the aerial demonstration team of the Air Force. And they were flying F-86s, okay? And I looked at that and I went, wow, that looks cool. That looks like something to be fun to do. So I think that's when the bug hit me. And then what I did was when I was young, and I started, I think it was right around 18, I actually had a driver's license, and I would use my father's car when he would let me. And I drove over to Teterboro on 46, and you know, I try to save up enough for, you know, one or two lessons at a time. And then when I had the next batch, I'd go back over and do it again. So that's how it started. And don't ask me why, but other than that, it just seemed like something to do.
And, did you get the license there or not until you were in the Air Force?
No, okay. And actually, I never really picked up the paperwork, because in the old days, what you're supposed to have done is, after you had all the flying hours, et cetera, you had to do the written end of it. Now, most of the pilots who come out of the Air Force do it right at the end when they're graduating or getting their wings. It wasn't that way when I was in, and I just never did, you know, the extra stuff, which is kind of funny, because recently, about a year or so ago, I decided I was going to go back, and I had done it once or twice before and just start flying again. It had been almost 20 years, and I went out in the first 15 minutes. If you observed it from the ground, you would have thought that Bozo the Clown was at the stick. And but after a while, it came back to me. But they wanted me to give my my medical on my blood pressure and everything else. And since I don't go to doctors, I couldn't. And so the jury's still out on that, whether I'll go back.
Hasn't
but anyway, that's how I got it.
As an aside, my wife was a pilot years ago, and she was in Cincinnati on business for 6 months, so she learned to fly. And she has the worst sense of direction in the United States. And so she was on a cross-country flight from Cincinnati to Indianapolis. Her radio went out, and she got lost. And she landed on a farmer's field. And she spent the night there. And then the next day, they opened the highway for her. And apparently, in most states, if you land, you can't fly out. They have to cart the way. Well, wherever she was in Indiana, they didn't have to do that, and they let her fly out.
Good for her. And by the way, you tell her I can identify with her, because on my first solo cross country, I was paying more attention to the music than I was to the Omni, whose radio directional finder. It was what they used in those days before all these GPSs and everything else. Anyway, to make a long story short, I sized up on what I thought was the field, okay, and I'm talking to what, again, I thought was the tower when I found out later it was a flight service was all it was, so they didn't have a tower. Anyway, to make a long story short, as I pull out on final and I'm coming in for a landing, and then I finally spot, and there's two or three trucks in the middle of the, quote, runway that I'm landing at, okay, and I go, whoa, and I pull up. And I get on the horn, and I start talking to what, again, I thought originally was the tower and the flight service. They, of course, informed me they were only a flight service, but they would run out and check. And they did. And they came back in and very politely told me that they don't have any trucks on their runway. I said, oh, okay. So at that point, they advised me to go up to 5,000 feet, and they'd pick me up on Newark radar. This was actually in Salisbury, Maryland, was where I was flying to. And anyway, by the time I get up about 4,500 feet, something like that, and I'm sure your wife knows that these small puddle jumpers, it takes forever to get to altitude. So anyway, by the time I got up there, I'm looking at the gas gauges and what have you, and from all the screwing around and, you know, attempting to land at the wrong airport, things are beginning to get a little low, and by that point I had noticed that it was a field, and the guy's coming on. He says, well, let's see if we can verify on Newark radar to make sure it's the right field and all this other business. And I said, I don't know what field it is or whose it is, but I'm going down because I'm running out of fuel. Anyway, it turned out to be the right fuel. So tell your wife I can identify with her and tell her I also took jets into Mexico, which I can now admit since the statute of limitations has passed. Because I couldn't identify Sycamore Creek from the Rio Grande. Navigation was not my forte either.
A fellow yesterday landed a Piper Cub on the Major Deacon. He was having problems.
I did see that, you know. And, of course, you know, and I'm sure you're aware of this, but, you know, the United States highway system was originally built in the 50s during the Cold War.
Right.
And the irony is, and a lot of people don't realize it, that, what is it, every couple of miles they have to have like 2 miles of straightaway, because they were anticipating, you know, God forbid, World War III, where they were going to have to land planes on the highways. So it's good for pilots, but, you know, what can I say? But, yeah, I did see that. Where was it, John? Was it right there?
It was still in the Bronx. It was just north of West 233rd Street.
Okay.
By the way, we're for John Donnelly and Gene O'Neill in Yogurt Shepherd class, they both wound up as Air Force colonels.
Yes, exactly. John Donnelly was the – who was the other fellow?
Gene O'Neill.
No, Gene was, but John was. Yeah, John definitely was in my class. Yeah, absolutely. And somebody did tell me that. I never ran into him, but somebody did tell me John went on to be a career in the Air Force.
Yeah, he runs some kind of either Air Force or flying museum out in the state of Washington.
So, oh, wow. Good for him. That's
what did you major in at Fordham?
Well, I started out as a chemistry major, and I had this habit in high school and most of the grade schools of believing that I could get through school without reading the books, and I was fortunate to get away with it for a great number of years until I hit Fordham, and when I hit Diffie-Q and calculus, et cetera, it dawned on me that it actually would help if you opened the books. So I switched from chemistry over to, when I went over to the auditorium, they, you know how in the old days, I don't know if they did it. You went to Manhattan, right, John?
Iona,
okay. In any event, they used the gym, and they'd have all these various, you know, places in your sophomore year to sign up for your majors and what have you. And I eyeballed all of this, and I said, what's the shortest line? And the shortest line was political science. So that's what I wound up as. And the sad part is my sister told me that my nephew followed my footsteps with political science. And I told her that story, and she said, don't you dare ever tell my son that. But that is the truth of how I did the major. The thing was, when I got out of high school, I wanted to go into the Air Force immediately. They had a program, Aviation Cadet, which only required high school. And the year I graduated, they canceled that program, and they made it 2 years of college. So in the second year, when I completed my second year at Fordham, I went back and said, okay, guys, I'm here. I got my 2 years. And they said, well, we're really sorry. Guess what? That program's been canceled, and it takes 4 years. So in more ways than one, the Air Force was responsible for me getting college education.
Did you have plans for post-Air Force career in the law, or did that develop while you're in the service?
It developed while I was in the service. For reasons that I choose not to get into tonight, I got grounded at one point, and after doing some things that perhaps I wasn't supposed to do, I then knew that my flying was over, okay? And at that point, I chose to look elsewhere for a job. And the only two things that actually came to mind, and you can know, you know, you probably recognize this coming out of, again, out of Inwood, was NYPD, okay, and law. And the NYPD, of course, you know, I'm sure like most of the guys in Inwood, I had more relatives and what have you in the NYPD than I knew what to do with, as well as friends. But my former wife, who's deceased now, I brought her back. She was a country girl out of Ohio, which is how I got tied into Ohio. And I knew after 15 minutes she'd never going to make it in New York. And that wasn't an indictment of her as much as it was maybe of New York. But in any event, that's how I wound up in Ohio State. And, you know, the whole picture, if you will. But,
you mentioned more NYPD people than you could shake a stick at. Like my father, grandfather, and godfather were all NYPD.
Yep.
Was Vietnam on the radar when you first signed up for ROTC, or did it turn out to be a big surprise as you became closer to a commission?
Yeah, it was. The best I can tell you is I can remember vividly when I was in flying school, we were playing poker into the wee hours of the morning, a bunch of the guys. And a couple of us, how insane this is going to sound, but we're decrying the fact that we thought that this, whatever you want to call it, police action, whatever you want to call it, in that time frame, was going to be over, and all they were, quote, flying was, at that point, was World War II stuff. They were flying A-1Es, B-25s, B-26s, you know, stuff that was, you know, holdovers from World War II. That's how intelligent we were about the whole thing. So, no, in answer to your question, it really wasn't, but the guys I was with, that years, et cetera, became, I mean, he couldn't have planned it better if you wanted to go to war, because it just fit perfectly with when the war started to build up.
You mentioned in your note to me that you took the LSATs and denying the weakness of Tet Offensive in 68.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Well, first of all, let me say that I thought that I was going to take it in Japan, okay? And that's the truth, okay? And I was as surprised as anybody to learn that they were going to give it in Da Nang. Now, Tet, as everybody knows, came on its own, so it was somewhat of a surprise. But in fairness, Tet started, and I can tell you exactly, because I was driving, had a master sergeant driving me down in the 6x down to Da Nang Air Force Base, and having been there already in 65, 66, this is, of course, 68 at this point. At that point, when all kinds of fireworks are going off and what have you, I knowledgeably said to the master sergeant, "Oh, don't worry, that's the Lunar New Year. They do that all the time." Shows you how observant I was. But anyway, getting back to it, within about 3 or 4 days into Tet, and where I was in I Corps, which is where Da Nang is. In fact, we used to fly in and out of Fubai and those areas that you see in that. I don't know if you ever saw that movie, Full Metal Jacket.
Yeah.
But that was where Wei and Fubai was one air stop, if you will, before you hit a northern one that I was stationed at for a while, which was Dang Ha. But anyway, they set it up. There was, I think, either 5 or 6 of us. And we went into a Quonset hut in Da Nang, Tinshore Naval Station, Deepwater Pier. And it was, it was ironic, I suppose. Here you are taking the law school aptitude test. And the other guys were, I think there was 4 Army and 1 Marine Corps guy and me. So I guess it was 6, okay. But again, don't quote me. It's been too many years. And I had me being Air Force, I had a sidearm is all I had. And we took our arms off and went in and sat down and took the test in the Quonset hut. And it was like, I say, 3 or 4 days into Tet. I did meet another fella who was an assistant USA out of Jersey years later who took it. But he took it in the second round, which was like in the fall. Don't ask me exactly when. So the best I can gather, during the whole war, I'm assuming that they probably only had about 100 people take it. They did give it at Saigon, and they did give it at Da Nang, but I'm guessing they only had a handful each time. But it was kind of interesting.
I know that you served two tours in Vietnam. Where else were you stationed while you were in the service?
I was stationed in Japan. As a matter of fact, that's how I got down. I was stationed in Kansas, Texas, and I was stationed in Japan. I was, once I was out of training, I was in what was known as the Tactical Air Command. And the Vietnam War for the Air Force lent itself to the Tactical Air Command, unlike, other services where it was spread around. The Strategic Air Command, which was, your big bombers, et cetera, until Nixon brought them in, the 52s, to do the bombing, later in the war, for the most part, the SAC didn't have a great participation. They stayed and did, the SAC thing. So TAC was heavy into it. And we were in the Pacific. I mean, if it was, you'd get off the plane and they'd hand you a new set of orders to the Pacific. So I was stationed in between at Fuchu Air Force Base in Japan, but I was all over there. I was at Yokota, Tachikawa, Naha, Kadena, and Okinawa. I was in and out of all over Thailand, Karat, Udon, Ubon, Chiang Mai, et cetera, et cetera. I've lost track, but we were in and around all those places. And it was... But I got back down the second time because I was trying to get out in time for law school, and I realized that if I volunteered for a second tour down there, I would be able to get out in 1 year, which was an exception. If you were commissioned in those days, you had to do 2 years unaccompanied to a tour or 3 accompanied, and so I would have been in much longer on active duty, and that's how that started. So that was my choice.
After completing law school at Ohio State, you joined the FBI. What made you choose investigation rather than other positions in public or private service?
Well, you know, I suspect, you know, I told you a little while ago I was influenced by a trailer in a movie at Barrytown. I hate to confess to this, but I was probably influenced in that. Again, nobody was in the family. NYPD was in the family, but nobody in the bureau. Many years ago when I was a kid, my mother and father took me on a trip down to Washington, D.C. And in those days, everything was in, actually in my day too, everything was in the Justice Department. And that's where they had the exhibits and everything. And I don't know what age I was, 10, 11, 12, who knows. But we went down to the range in the Justice Building where the FBI was giving demonstrations. And the agent, and I think I was probably the only kid at this particular, you know, exhibit or whatever you want to call it. And at that juncture, the guy started cutting loose with one of the old Thompsons, okay? And he was firing at a silhouette and what have you. And, of course, I was, I think, again, as being the only kid, he brought the target after he brought it, he rolled it back in, and he gave it to me, this paper target. And actually, I think he gave me a couple of the brass from the Tommy gun. Well, that was it, okay? So years later, I think that probably had as much of an impact on me as to why I wanted to do it, because when I came out of Ohio State, I had a law school professor, in fact, two of them. One of them set me up for an interview with the NLRB, and which I didn't ask for or anything else. And the fellow had practically at the end said, you know, you haven't even put an application in. He says, but I can pretty well assure I can get you a job as a trial examiner. And then the other one was a fellow named Nordstrom who wrote the book on negotiable instruments and everything else. And he said, Jim, why are you going at the FBI? I mean, you know, you blah, blah, blah. And I said, I don't know why, because I just feel like I got to do it, you know. It's one of those things. I don't know what it was, John, in my early years, but there was a, I don't know, maybe it came out of Inwood, but it was an adrenaline streak or something. But
well, we also had, growing up, we had those two radio shows, This Is Your FBI and the FBI in Peace and War, and then we had, in our high school or college years, we had Efren Zimbalist on the FBI show on TV. So
yes.
It was a heavy influence.
You're probably right, yeah.
I know that you were involved in some interesting cases while in the FBI, both in Buffalo, New York, and then Minneapolis, Minnesota. Would you tell us about some of them?
Sure. And it's kind of funny. First of all, you have to understand, when you come out, in my day in the FBI, you did OJT in Washington, D.C., for a couple of weeks before they turned you loose on the world, and you went to what they call your first office agent. In the PD, as you well know, they call you rookies, but in the Bureau they used to. I don't know if they still do. It's been so many years, but they used to call you first office agents. My introduction to OJT with the Bureau was with a fellow named DePue, who was one of the first profilers. And hell of a nice guy. So I did a couple of weeks with him, and then I went to Buffalo. Anyway, as a first office agent, you don't get any kind of decent cases. You get whatever's left over or whatever. And we used to call them the heavies, you know, the fellows who had been there for years, et cetera. And Buffalo, even though it only had about 100 agents, was a pretty heavy criminal investigative agency. Because you had, at that time, the Stefano Magadino family, which I'm sure you've watched the movies, et cetera, on the Mafia, et cetera. And the Magadinos are well known. They go all the way back. They were originally, you know, one of the original families, if you will. So there was a lot of crime, if you will, going on. But again, it was the heavies, is what we called them, who did most of the big cases when they came along. The exception to the rule was if they accepted the young guys coming in as stand-up guys, if that makes sense. And a lot of the agents I went in with were, quite frankly, Vietnam vets. But anyway, the story that goes with it, which I thought was kind of comical, was we were out on an apprehension, and two of the guys, the heavies, were after this one particular guy. In those days, we went after unlawful flights to avoid prosecution and unlawful flight to avoid confinement, if you will. And I don't know what the case was. It wasn't mine to begin with. Myself and another young agent We're sitting in the car. It's usual weather in Buffalo, snow and ice on the streets, a narrow street down in the suburbs. And the two heavies are inside interviewing the relatives of this guy we're looking for. And in the course of it, we're looking down the street, and I see this guy sitting in the car. And I turned to this other fellow, Reggie was his name. I said, Reggie, doesn't that guy in a, you know, that's sitting there in that car, doesn't he look like the guy we're looking for? And Reggie said, you know, Jim, I think you're right. I think that might be the guy. In the meantime, the guy gets out, and he's screwing around with the tire or doing some damn thing. And it looks like he's making sure it's not flat or whatever. And then he gets in the car, and he's, you know, rubbing the engine. And, of course, there's ice in, so he's kind of slipping and sliding a little bit. So at this point, Reggie and I, quick on the draw that we were, I'm being facetious, said, you know what, let's go up and check this guy out. So he gets out on the passenger side, and he's walking up on the sidewalk. Yours truly gets out on the driver's side, and I'm walking up in the middle of the street. Now, you have to understand this is the day of Hoover, okay? That's when we were, you know, we're talking about. And you had the standard uniform was, you know, top coat, suit, tie, et cetera, okay? And so no sooner did I hit the street and I'm walking towards this guy in a car who's now in the car trying to get it going, okay, then he makes me, sure. Now he's really trying to get the damn thing going, but he's sliding on the ice, right? So by the time I get up to the car is sliding. I yank the door open and pull him out. But it looks for all the world like the car was, you know, he was trying to, quote, hit me with the car, for lack of a better term, which wasn't the case, right? Anyway, we turn the guy over to the bad guy, to the heavies, and they take him down because it was their collar and the whole bit. And, you know, we went about our business. And when I go back into the office later on, the supervisor calls me, and he says, Jim, we're going to get an affidavit together for you to sign to prosecute this guy on assault on a federal officer. And I said, Denny, what the hell are you talking about? He said, well, you know, he tried to run you over, didn't he? I said, no. I said, he was just trying to get out of there. That's all he was doing. I said, his car was sliding. He wasn't trying to run me over, you know. Anyway, the more I protested, John, the more they thought I was being heroic, okay, which is what got me accepted into the heavies, okay. That's the prelude to the story, if you will. Thereafter, we had a series of cases up there, but one of the best ones that I always thought was, it was a very serious case, too, but it was also sort of a Keystone Cop type situation. Around the end of the month, we always did reports, and we always went in to the office so we could do the reports. So if you went to an FBI office in those days, and I don't know if this is true today with computers and all, but you would find, you know, probably three-quarters of the agents would be in the office writing their reports for the month. Excuse me. Anyway, around that time, and all of this is happening simultaneously, four of these guys do a takedown on a Marine Midland bank that happens to be only about three or four blocks from the FBI office, okay? And you got to picture all of this happening, as I say, simultaneous. In the meantime, two Buffalo PD cops who were on scooters, if I remember correctly, just decided it was lunchtime to go into the lunchroom, which was across the street from the bank, okay? Now, at the time these guys go in, they park on this side street. It's very narrow, which I thought, quite frankly, was one way, but it was actually two ways, but it was very, very narrow, okay? They go into the bank, and when they go into the bank, they park the getaway car, and a truck comes for delivery, okay? And it stops or parks right where the bad guy's getaway car is, right? Now, by the way, these guys had ripped off a bunch of banks. They were serious guys, but and they were all armed, et cetera. So they go in, and it's a small branch bank, and the guy who's at the front is like a VP of loans or whatever. And as they go in, the guy's talking on the phone. Okay, now, this guy is sort of, how shall I say it, henpecked, I guess is the best way to describe it, but he's the kind of guy who would never hang up on his wife in 1,000 years, okay? And he's talking to his wife. The guy tells him to hang up the phone, the bad guy. He doesn't do it quick enough, and this is the not funny part. He pistol whips him across the face. The guy, of course, immediately drops the phone. The woman on the other end is smart enough to know that he would never dare hang up on her. she immediately dials, you know, whatever the equivalent, I don't know, it was 911 then or whatever, but she dials the cops and the FBI gets into it. We get the tip in the office that's only like three blocks away. Some of the guys ran for cars and what have you, but some of us said, Marie Miller, geez, you got to be kidding. That's right down the street. So we raced down. So all of this happened simultaneously. The cops come out of the lunchroom across the street. We're coming up the street running, okay, and these bad guys are coming out to find that their car is blocked in by a truck, and they're trying to back it up on the sidewalk to get away, and they finally abandoned the car with about, I think it was $56,000 is what they had, which was a big haul for those days. Anyway, to make a long story short, the unfunny part was one of the guys was shot in the butt. We got three of them. We couldn't find the fourth one, and one of the fellas is looking for one of the bad guys, and there's a kid standing on the corner. I don't know what age again, but a youngster. And he looks up at the agent. He says to him, he said, are you looking for the guy in the, I don't know, blue shirt or whatever it was? And he says, yeah, he's in that building right over there on the first floor. And sure as hell, that's where he was. So that was, I thought that was kind of funny. I mean, again, these guys were bad guys. And Farringer, the criminal lawyer, who I think later defended Flint, was their lawyer when it came to trial, and they were convicted. But, you know, it was Keystone Cop all the way. These guys' luck had definitely run out. And that was one. We had a couple of others. We had a nationwide extortion case and then an armed hijacking that was, at that time, one of the biggest armed hijackings they'd had. But,
and then you had a big one out in Minneapolis, too, didn't you?
Yeah. From there, I was assigned to the Piper kidnapping case, which there was a whole team of us. I think it was maybe about 20 guys. And the case didn't come into fruition until after I had gone. But if you've ever seen that movie Fargo, at least a portion of it, not the whole thing, is supposedly partially a mimic of the Piper case. And what it was a wife of a stockbroker. I think he was retired at the time, but a very rich stockbroker. And her name was Virginia Piper, if I remember correctly. But she was kidnapped from her home. Her maid was tied up, et cetera, et cetera. And she was literally chained to trees out in the boondocks. God bless her. She was a tough gal. She was a tough gal. And they demanded $1 million in ransom. And the husband agreed to pay it. And it was paid, et cetera, et cetera. There ultimately was convictions in it, but the convictions were overturned years later by an appellate court. But it was a fascinating case. And the first thing we had to do when we reported to the team was listen to the tapes, because the lady, she was really a tough character. She did an audio interview within hours after she was freed from, you know, where they literally chained her to the trees out in the woods. And she, you know, told everything she could, and so we listened to it. But it was a fascinating case.
That might have been the Piper, the family that was in the brokerage firm. There's a large brokerage firm in Minneapolis, Piper
yes,
Jaffe.
That's it, exactly. Yep.
Okay.
That's it, for sure, yeah. And that's where they had the money. The money, by the way, which was unknown to the bad guys at the time, even though they gave the money, and again, the FBI's policy at the time, again, I can't speak to what they do these days. I mean, that's a whole different ballgame. But the FBI policy at that time was the family decrees how they're going to handle it. If they want to pay it, they pay it. If they don't want to pay it, that's fine. If they want the FBI involved in the actual drop of the money, et cetera, the FBI gets involved. If they don't, the FBI backs off until, you know, after it takes place. And that's exactly what happened in this case. The FBI was not involved in actually the drop, which is why, you know, they got the money, et cetera. But they were notified to the point where the money, even though it seemed that it was random, okay, was actually all of the serial numbers on all of the $20 bills that we used had been recorded. And then what they had done is, and don't ask me how they did it because I wasn't there when they did that part of it, but they had been reshuffled to seem as if they were random. when in fact they weren't. And we literally had books on the teams of every serial number that was on every one of those bills. And part of the investigative part, which I assure you will never be on TV because it's tedious and boring, was to check the local banks. I think like every Friday we used to have to go down and check serial numbers to see if any of it had turned up. So, you know, very, very, very unromantic portion of the job.
You eventually moved from the FBI to the State Attorney General's office in Ohio. What prompted that change?
Well, you know, first I had several fellows who had graduated from law school with me. And, you know, to set the stage again, as with many things in those days, part of my drive was the adrenaline thing. Let's go do something different, you know, in my, how shall I say it, simplistic mind. I would think, well, gee, I mastered this. Let's see if I can move on to something else, which, of course, I hadn't mastered. But anyway, that was my thinking. The other part was I was married at the time, and my wife, her brother was in the squadron that we had replaced the first year, the first time I went over to Vietnam, and he was killed. And he, actually, if you've ever read the book, Tom Clancy's book with General Horner, who was the air chief in Iraq, was a captain in Vietnam and knew my former wife's brother. And it's described in the book, Every Man a Tiger, the day that they were shot down. He was, a long story. But anyway, so she had lost a brother over there, and that's, we met when I was stationed in Kansas. And how shall I say it? She was not enamored with the FBI life, the moving around, I don't think it was that dangerous, but, you know, she did. And so that was part of it. The other part of it was I had two fellows who had graduated from law school with me who were chomping at the bit for me to come back and practice law with them in Columbus. Ultimately, I did that, and supposedly, one of them had lots of connections and did with people who were fairly well off. But it wasn't at that point that it hadn't dawned on me that rich people who have a choice are going to go to experienced lawyers as opposed to new kids. So all the contacts didn't do much. And that brought up the point where one of us had to go out and make a living because we weren't doing enough in the private practice to feed all three of us. So that's when I went with the Attorney General's office. And, candidly, part of the sell was that I had, some criminal investigative experience, et cetera, et cetera. So that's how I wound up there. And I wound up working there for about 3 years and then went back into the private practice that I had maintained.
What were some of the duties of an assistant attorney general per state?
Well, we had, a number. I worked in what was the criminal activities division. We did an awful lot of post-conviction and appellate work. We did the defense work for, if the governor's Department of Correction. By the way, the governor at the time was Gilligan, who is the father of Sebelius, who is the head of HHS at the present time. Yeah, so it comes around. What can I tell you? But anyway, so you would defend the corrections department if they were, brought up on what they call under color of state law violations, 42 U.S.C. 1983. And then we did some original work. We did some gambling probes and some search and seizures, if you will, and then prosecutions thereafter, and that kind of thing. And, so it was kind of a potpourri of a number of cases.
A series of events led you back into the Air Force, first in the reserves and into active duty, but this time as the lawyer rather than as a pilot. Could you take us through those developments?
Sure. In the early days, and again, I know it has changed. You won't find it written anywhere, but apparently, as I understand the story, during World War II, what happened was an awful lot of the fellas who were FBI agents were also in the reserves, okay, and immediately got called up when the war broke out because, you know, they were essentially well-trained intelligence officers, and they, you know, the government wanted them, let's put it that way, the military wanted them. That did not make Hoover very happy. So after the war, it was an unwritten policy that you could be in the reserves, but not in what was known as the ready reserves. In other words, you could have the status, but you couldn't do the actual duty, if you would. Okay, and I found that out the hard way when I told them they wanted me to participate in the reserves, and they said you can't. But you won't find that written anywhere. Now I understand maybe 10, 20 years ago, some agent long after Hoover was dead challenged that, and there is no longer that policy. Or, you won't find it anywhere. Anyway, at that point, once I left the FBI, I decided that, hey, I would go back to it for two reasons. One, it was extra income, quite frankly. And then the other thing was I always figured that in the next war, I noticed two things. The higher ranks certainly lived a better life in war, okay? And the second part was I thought that the next one, I would try my hand throwing law books as opposed to something else. So that was the basis for it. That's how basically I went back in. And at that juncture, there was a fellow who was the associate dean of Ohio State who had been one of the first staff judge advocate, two-star general of the Air Force. Kufelt was his name. And heck of a nice man. And I knew him. He knew me. And next thing I know, they took me into the reserves as a judge advocate. That's how that started. And now how I got back on active duty is a little bit different, but
But how'd that happen?
Well, what happened there was, and this is from a personal standpoint, My ex-wife, who is now deceased, but at that time we had been having some problems, and quite frankly, 90% of it was probably me because if you haven't got a picture of this, I was a little wild and woolly in my youth, as opposed to sedate these days. But anyway, we got a divorce is essentially it. And my ties to Ohio had all been as a result of her, quite frankly. And at that point, even though I had a private practice and it was, it was becoming fairly successful at that point, but I thought, what the hell do I really want to, what am I doing here, why am I here? And so as a result of that, I decided, well, maybe it's time to close the doors, et cetera, et cetera. And I took some time off. I was going to go up to Alaska. And I had one more case to try, which was kind of a very interesting case. But after that particular case, it was so late that by the time I got started, by the time I hit Wyoming, I realized that the Trans-Canadian Highway was definitely out for this neophyte, at least for a while. So at that point, one of the colonels who knew me had gotten an inquiry from the Pentagon that they had a class action EEO case going on down in Eglin Air Force Base down in Florida. And they were looking for trial lawyers who were familiar with federal procedure, federal trial work, et cetera, which I had done a fairly good amount of, both in the private sector and in the Attorney General's office. And I said to them, well, I'll come back on active duty if you at least guarantee me a year. And they said they could do that. They would waive this, that, and the other thing. And the year wound up almost four is what had happened. And that's basically how I got back on. But
You mentioned in your notes to me that you then became a civilian employee as the labor lawyer. Was that in the Department of Labor?
Yeah. No, it wasn't in the Department of Labor. It was with DOD. What happened was, and how that came about was, to tell you the truth, they had waived just about everything every statute you could waive to keep me on active duty, okay, for the class action. So as the time was running out, the class action had fairly well died down, but it was a lot of work to do at the end, the far end, millions of dollars of attorney fee applications, all kinds of things going on. So they literally created a civilian labor job for me. And
oh, okay.
That's how I came into it, in essence. Yeah.
That brings us to administrative judge years. And I took a course in administrative law as part of a criminal justice major in grad school, but I'd wager that most people have no clue of the difference between an administrative law judge and a civil court judge is. Would you explain the difference and also tell us what interests you in that
field? And it's funny because I was right with you. I didn't know much of their existence. A buddy of mine who I knew, again, from the Air Force, who liked to say that he was, quote, unelected as a municipal court judge. That is to say, he lost the election after he'd been in office for more than a few years, was the one who put me onto it. And he said, and this is when I was still down doing labor law work, and he said, Jim, with your years of litigation, you know, this is this is the kind of thing you should do. And he briefed me. Essentially, what the federal administrative law judge positions are about, they're actually in about maybe 30 agencies. And some agencies only have one administrative law judge. Then you have big ones like Social Security that have as many as 1,200 or more at this point. I don't know. But there's probably 2,000 across the United States. Again, give or take a few one way or another. And it's probably the only competitive tested judgeship in the United States. And it's actually part of the executive branch. But it answers only to, in most cases, the secretary of the various agencies. Now, in some of the agencies, they have a step in between the secretary, an appellate, an administrative appeals section. But essentially, they are, they do, how shall I say it, the thousands and thousands and thousands of cases that are right below the United States District Court, if you will. Now, when I say right below it, don't misunderstand me. They can be very small cases, very minor amounts of money. Well, quite frankly, they can be millions of dollars. And depending on what agency you're dealing with, they can be a matter of an hour hearing, or they can be a matter of days, weeks, or months. So it varies from agency to agency. The actual selection process, you have to, and again, it has changed over the years, but when I went in, essentially, you put in your credentials, et cetera. You go through an initial qualification, if you will, and then you're tested. There's an actual written test. And then after the test, you're ranked. And then after that, they send out information to the most 10 most important cases you've dealt with. And they want to talk to the opposition attorneys, the judges, et cetera, et cetera. And then you go to a panel interview that includes usually one administrative law judge, if not two, usually a prominent lawyer, and then usually a senior executive with the Office of Personnel Management. And then after that, you're placed on the list. Depending on where you are on the list, in the old days, there was only maybe 25 appointed a year. But when Social Security Disability started getting so many cases and they started appointing more judges, it got to maybe 100, 150 a year. But in terms of a federal labor law job, or I shouldn't say labor law, but law job, if you will, it's a plum. It's probably the next best, thing that you get if you don't have political connections and can't make the district court appointment with a magistrate. That's basically it.
Your career as an administrative judge, when I saw, boggles my mind, a number of cities, various levels of authority, retirements and unretirements. Would you take us through this portion of your life in some detail?
Sure. I was originally hired. I was lucky enough to do quite well on the testing, and I was hired in the first group off what they call the register at that particular time, and I was offered a position with the Social Security Administration doing disability hearings. I had the opportunity to go many times after that with labor law and a few of the other things I actually had more experience with. But the beauty of the Social Security Administration is they had 140 offices throughout the United States, and they were in locations where you weren't paying the premium prices, if you will, of Washington, D.C., New York City, Miami, Atlanta, et cetera. So I chose to stay with them is basically it. And then one of the hearing office chiefs where I worked got older and retired, a hell of a nice guy. And I took over. I was appointed the head of that office. And then not too long, a couple of years after that, I was offered a position on the West Coast in Oregon, running an office out there. And did that for a number of years, and then I was offered a position in Seattle, Washington. And I was only there a few years when I had put in an application for what amounted to a brand new agency, the Office of Medicare Hearings and Appeals, that hadn't even been, set up yet. And I was interviewed by the Assistant Secretary of Health and Human Services at the time. And after a couple of interviews, I was selected. And that was kind of funny because they wanted me to go from Seattle, Washington. They told me I said, how soon do you want me down in Miami is where they selected me. And they said, well, how about, the next couple of days? And I said, you got to be kidding me. It's 3,500 miles from Seattle to, Miami. So anyway, I went down there, and my job was to set up that portion of the agency. I was like the second person selected for the agency. This was in 2005. And we, at that point, controlled the appeals for 13 states and territories, including the Virgin Islands, which I never got to hold a hearing in. I still decry that. And it was fantastic. I never had that kind of thing happen in my entire federal career. I was in a motel in Miami for 4 months, hiring people, getting the office ready. We occupied like three levels, three full floors on the Bank of America building that you see on, the old Miami Vice, the curve building that you always see in the backdrop. And I guess by the time we finished, I had about 160 people, about 40 lawyers, about 20 judges, and the rest was support staff, paralegals, et cetera. And it was a fascinating experience. The only thing that ever concerned me was that I was operating out of a motel room, as I said, and I kept shooing away the maids, et cetera, because I was still doing interviews or whatever at times, and I'm sure they thought I was running a meth lab or something in there. So I was surprised it wasn't a raid. But anyway, so that's what I did. And then I had planned on retiring. That was to be my swan song. And I did. I retired effective January of 2009. And I was happily in retirement for about 4 years. And I got the call from the chief, the new chief of Medicare Office of Hearings and Appeals, who, again, reports directly to the secretary. And she asked me, first through intermediaries and then directly, whether I would, care to take on the job of doing the same job I did in Miami, only this time for the northeastern quadrant up in Cleveland. And again, they had to go back to OPM and get waivers as a rehired annuitant, et cetera. So it was for a year, and that's what I did. They asked me to renew it, and I initially agreed. And then at some point about a month or so ago, I said, you know what? I'm getting too long, old in the tooth. It's time to call it a day again. So I did, but I understand they got a pool going as to how long it'll last again, but that's another story.
The thing that's always impressing about you, even more than your accomplishments, is your same constant thirst for knowledge. You and I disagree on a number of political things, but our conversations have never been confrontational, but rather discussions. And in the non-political area, you seem to be on an ongoing quest to learn more about religion, belief, our place in the world. I know this a big topic, but can you give us some insight into your feelings and thoughts on what I've just said?
Sure. And, you know, it's funny you say that. I agree with you, John. First of all, in fact, it's funny. One of my relatives said to me one time, said, "Why do you read the New York Times? You just get mad. You know, you don't agree with a lot of what's said, et cetera, et cetera." And my first response, you'll get a kick out of, was you know, sort of, you know, semi-sarcastic, which was, "Well, I have to know the enemy." But the other part, I think, which is more realistic, is, you know, the truth is that, and I guess this is the Jesuit training from Fordham days, you know, I personally believe that anything of merit, anything that is true, albeit not absolute truth, but true, should be capable of examination. Otherwise, I just can't buy into it. Now, I understand that certain things like religion have to be accepted on faith. But having said that, I think the multitude of things that we look at on a day-to-day basis should be open to discussion, should be open to examination. And that's, you know, so you're absolutely right. I mean, I enjoy the give and take, okay? And, you know, to me, it's, you know, it's how I've made my living, you know, quite frankly, as an advocate, even that's, in those positions, you know.
If I can just interrupt for a second, that's one problem that you point out. I saw a study that 6% of the people who listen to the Rachel Maddow show are conservatives, and 8% of the people who listen to Hannity are liberals. We don't listen to the other side. And
absolutely.
And in the age of gerrymandering, where all these are safe seats, and when people only listen to the Limbos or to the Chris Matthews, what they're doing is they're just listening to people that agree with them, and it cements their own beliefs. And it's,
absolutely.
We're not in good shape that way, you know?
No, I agree with you, John, absolutely. And the other part of it is that each one of those people that you've named, as far as I'm concerned, even though I may have a bent that is established as X or Y, I disagree with, okay, in various positions. I don't believe in labels. I think they're damaging, okay? And I say that both from a religious standpoint. I think you remember years ago on your excellent neighborhood website, we posted something. Jim Casey and I went back and forth a little bit, but you know, and I tongue in cheek said, you know, I have a new building going up in Death Valley, dedicated to all religions, et cetera, et cetera. Labels, I forget exactly how I said it, but essentially labels count more than beliefs. Well, yeah, I was being obviously very facetious, okay, because I don't believe in labels. For example, if you were to examine my beliefs on the First Amendment and the Fourth Amendment exclusively, you would say I'm a flaming liberal, no question about it. Because I believe the First Amendment is one of our basic protections, okay, against either the right or the left, as far as that goes, going crazy, okay? And the same thing on the Fourth Amendment, you know. I may be labeled a conservative in other areas, but I sure as heck don't want cops beating down the door and arbitrarily searching my home or my car or whatever any more than anybody else, and I form a law enforcement, okay?
So the big problem,
I think, yeah.
Go ahead.
Sorry, John, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, it's you know, my theory with that is that when we put labels on people, we do them a disservice. And I think that, you know, you're a guy who's, you know, read so much, et cetera, et cetera. I couldn't possibly compete with you, but I think you would find, as I've found, that when we put label, be they on historic figures or literary figures, we do a disservice to them. Because, you know, as you rightly know, you can examine a Thomas Jefferson, and you can conclude that he's a racist, this, that, or the other thing, or you can conclude that he's the most liberal, free-thinking, you know, person on the face of the earth, depending upon what you read. And I think that's what makes human beings the way they are. I mean, we're so complex, you shouldn't, you know, do it. But that's my take, and I think the same thing with religion. I've come to the conclusion. I don't see, to the degree that I believe in a supreme being and an afterlife, et cetera, and I have lots of questions, and, you know, again, that's a subject for another area, but to the degree that I believe in all of that, I still never have believed in a God sitting up there sorting people by labels. I've met too many people that didn't have a good label, if you will, that were wonderful people, and too many SOBs that had the perfect label that were just that, SOBs. So I just can't see that. And perhaps I'll prove wrong. We'll know probably not too long in the next decade or so when I find out for sure. But that's my take on it.
Agreed.
Go ahead.
And it was interesting that two of the closest skiing and sailing buddies were Bill Buckley and John Kenneth Galbraith, who disagreed on just about everything economically and politically.
Yep.
But they're able to get along. We don't seem to see that very much anymore, you know?
No, and I think that my profession is one of the worst offenders. When I first came into it, I can truthfully tell you that I would try cases, be they civil and or criminal. And for the most part, I would walk out of the courtroom with the opposition attorneys, and we could go have a beer together across the street or something, and, you know, maybe pull each other's chains, you know, back and forth. But we respected each other. We laughed, okay? And we knew that we were playing a role, an important role. Don't misunderstand me. But we didn't, how shall I say it? We didn't become the cause itself. Now, I understand the 60s did many good things for the country in terms of examining this and examining the other thing, but I think we also fell into the trap of assuming the persona of those people that we were advocating for, and I think that's a big mistake. At some point in time, I defended what we affectionately or non-affectionately call kiddie diddlers, et cetera. And from a personal standpoint, they disgusted me. But they were still entitled to a defense, okay? That's what the system is about. And I think that we've lost that. We have people that this lady who's getting out now on a prison on a sympathetic release, et cetera, et cetera. I think she's a classic example. Whether you believe in her politics or not, that's not the question. She has assumed the persona of her clients, okay? She has become involved in their thing. That's not her purpose, at least as I see it. Her purpose was to be an advocate, a strong advocate, and that's good. That's the way it should be. But you don't get mixed up in it, you know? Anyway, that's my take.
The only way that I think to have gotten better is in the public's treatment of the veterans. There were the Vietnam veterans, they were treated rottenly, and they did not make the policy. They served as their asked to, whether they were way on the left or way on the right. They didn't choose to be there. Most of them, they were doing what they were supposed to do, as were the Iraq people, and were treating the Iraq people, at least the public is, not the government, but we're treating the Iraq and the Afghanistan people a hell of a lot with more respect than we treated the Vietnam vets.
Yes, and I think that the one good thing that came out of that war, and I said this, by the way, my son was doing something many years ago in terms of, it was basically a talk to a vet type thing, and of course he took the easy way out, talked to his dad, but, you know, we were talking about the Vietnam War, and at that point, Iraq I had already taken place. And I said to him, I said, one of the advantages that took place in Iraq, whether you favor the war or against the war, it doesn't matter, how it was conducted, okay, was much better because you had people in the top chairs, Horner in the air war, Schwarzkopf from the ground, et cetera, who were allowed to handle the war as military players. Admittedly, the ultimate decision to go to war is political. But having said that, they were allowed to do what they were trained to do. That wasn't Vietnam, okay? So we learned that lesson. And I thought at that time we had learned what the heck are we going in there for and what are the goals. I now believe that we never learned that lesson from recent events. We just don't get it. And that's the sad part because, it's one thing to lose lives in these things, as you well know, but it's another thing to look back and say, okay, why? Why did this happen? Why did we lose all of this? Guys from World War II, God bless them, they can look back and they can say, there was good reason for this, okay? This is what we accomplished. This is what we did. This is what it's all about. I'm not sure that in war since then we can say that. And that bothers me. I mean, it bothers me when I, as it happened, I get lawn chairs and they break down on me and I turn them over to repair them and I see made in Vietnam. And I say to myself, I'm angry because of the chair, not because of Vietnam, but I'm angry because of the chair and I'm saying to myself, what did we accomplish in there? Okay, we got 58,000 kids killed. Okay, they never got to see adulthood, and I'm not sure what we accomplished. Now, we can argue about whether it was good to go in there in the first place or not good to go in the first place, but what troubles me most is if you make the decision to go in, then have the wherewithal to do what the job is, whatever that is. And if you think it's a bad idea, don't go in the first place. And I know that's, I guess it's all tripe, but that's my take on it. And I just think we keep continuing to make that same mistake. And I'm talking too much. Go ahead, John.
No. That leads into another question. I know that in your long career in public service, it was not either appropriate or even permissible for you to publicly state your strong feelings on the political issues of the state of society. Do you plan to be writing or to be looking for a platform to express these feelings now?
Yeah, candidly, I do. I mean, I think there are things going on. There are things that, you mentioned a little while ago. You talked about in terms of, people talking together, whether it's, the Buckleys and the Galbraiths or whoever. And I agree with that. Maybe it's a misperception on my part, but when we were kids in the 50s, it seemed to me that both parties reached across the aisle. Nobody, it's the old adage they used to say about, if you see two people coming, a couple coming out of a divorce court, and they're both frowning, the odds are it's been a fair settlement, okay? If one is smiling, somebody got taken, okay? The problem I see with Congress and the whole government as a whole is the ideologues on both sides are running the show, and nobody's compromising, okay? And I think that in the 50s they did, and I think we need to get back.
I think the reason for that, and I was totally wrong then, I would point, as a person interested in political science, that there were the liberal Republicans, there were the Rockefellers, and there was the Javitses, and the conservatives, there were the Goldwaters and the Towers, and the liberal Democrats, the Humphreys and the Kennedys, and there were the conservative Democrats, who by and large were the racists out, but there was still some sharp people there, like Richard Russell and people like that. And now I used to say, gee, how come all the liberals aren't in one party and the conservatives in another? Well, to what happened then is that Lyndon Johnson and the Senate and Everett Dirksen, they would have to get consensus with their own party and then they could deal.
Mm-hmm.
When we got the liberal and the conservative party, they hate each other. The only way with the gerrymandered districts that anyone can move into politics, if you're a Republican, you have to go to the right of the incumbent, or if you're a Democrat, you have to go to the liberal, you have to try to beat him in the primary. It's a terrible situation.
I agree, and I think that one of the landmarks of it, I think, was when they changed the seniority system, because one of the clubs that, what Johnson had when he was a majority leader was that you don't play ball with me, you're going to be on the Interstate Bus Committee, Subcommittee of Transportation, okay? And as you well know, that's not done now, okay? It's sort of a popularity type thing more than anything else. And I think that's, I don't think anybody projected that was what was going to happen when they eliminated it. But I think that's one of the bad parts that's happened. And then I think it's, digging heels in with the ideologues. You did mention something, though, that I did get a kick out of when you mentioned Johnson. and you mentioned Goldwater. One of the great quotes, I'm sorry, but I'm going far afield, but do you remember the great quote of Bill Buckley? After Goldwater, of course, had been trounced in the election in 64, they said to him, "Well, now it's been a year," he said, "what do you think about that election, Mr. Buckley?" And he said, "Well," and, you know, that pause voice of his that I dearly loved, you know, Buckley, God bless him. Anyway, he said, "Well," he said, "they told me that if I voted for Goldwater, that the war in Vietnam would escalate." So I did, and it did. The man was a classic.
My two favorite things for him, one I saw in person, and one was the press conference, but he was running for mayor of New York. But Lindsay and with Beam, someone asked him what would be the first thing that he would do.
Oh, yes, go ahead, give it. I know, I love it.
And I said, demand a recount.
Yeah,
then I saw him years before that, a National Review used to have these Hunter College forums where they'd be on stage and they'd have guests and all this. So Buckley's taking questions from the audience. And some rather pompous professor gets up and says, "Mr. Buckley, in view of the fact that you hold this, 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 and this, doesn't it logically follow you must hold this, this, and this to reach the conclusion of this?" And Buckley said, "No." Next.
You know, not that I in any way put myself in the character of a genius like Bill Buckley, but I had an attorney write me one time. The normal course of events, you're not supposed to write directly to the client of an opposing attorney once they're represented. But in this particular case, there was a rationale for it that I won't get into. And I did. And the next thing I know, I get a letter from the opposing attorney. And he goes on and rambles on, et cetera, et cetera. He said, "Will you please tell me why you had the audacity to blah, 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 contact my attorney, contact my client directly, blah, blah, blah." And he went on and on and on. And I wrote a response back to him, and I said to him, "Reference your letter of such and such a date, subject as above, period. Next paragraph, no. Yours truly, Jim Caulfield."
Maybe
sometimes it would work.
Maybe you heard that.
I hadn't heard it before. I got to be honest with you, but sometimes one word can suffice, you know. But I love Bill Buckley. His quotes, what was it he said about Lyndon Johnson, the man of his most recent word?
However, he did admit that his grandfather had voted for Lyndon Johnson 6 years after he died.
I would have loved to have met him. Did you say you actually met him, John?
Oh, well, he was at the thing, but I have this great letter from him that I talked about doing some consulting work. He was the editor of the Yale Daily News, and my oldest friend Kevin Buckley was the next editor of the Yale Daily News.
Oh, wow.
And then Kevin became Newsweek's Vietnam guy during the war, and he did a profile on Creighton Abrams for the Times. And he said that when he was at Yale, Bill was very active in the – still coming back and very active in the newspaper. So when he they used to exchange letters, and they were on opposite sides of the war. Kevin was disillusioned, I believe, by the war and everything that he saw there. So they didn't talk – for a bit, but he sent him a letter about something. It was, "Dear Mr. Buckley," and he got a letter back. "Dear Kevin, I was always Bill. I hope you didn't let a little thing like a war come between us."
I don't know. The more I read of him, the more I loved him. I think I had every of his novels. I wasn't too enamored with his novel writing, you know. But I certainly loved his quotations from Chairman Bill,
right?
And of course, you know, all of the other various ones that I can't think of right now. But he was fantastic.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. No, I was going to say, that was equally true of you talk of the old timers, you talk about Stevenson and what have you. I mean, you had some brilliant men back then. I'm sorry, now it's, who can give the best soundbite,
Well, when Robert Taft...
That scares me.
when Robert Tipp was the front runner for the Republican nomination before Eisenhower came in, he and Adlai Stevenson, one was considered Mr. Conservative, it was the liberal, and they both published position papers that people read. Then I remember when Goldwater ran for president, Ronald Reagan gave this what they called the speech. He spoke for 45 and 50 minutes, and he was a former actor. This was before he was governor or anything. And people said, you know, he gave a great speech. He should be in politics. How many people do you know would watch a candidate, and Reagan wasn't even the candidate, talk for 45 minutes on television now? It'd be they'd be calling the radio station because Two and a Half Men weren't on, you know?
You got it. I agree, John. And that's, you know, that's a problem with the news, too, though. You know, and that's something with my kids I tried to inculcate them. I'm not sure I did it successfully or not. Time will tell. But, you know, the sound bites don't cut it. I mean, it's one thing to make a judgment, whether it's about, you know, a particular battle, a war, or a crisis, or, you know, the sit-down in Wall Street, or whatever it is. It's one thing to make a value judgment based upon an analysis of at least most of the facts, okay? It's another thing to make an analysis based on the soundbite of somebody, with all due respect, whose major qualifications is they have a good haircut and they can read a teleprompter. And I hate to say it, but that's what we've gotten into. Think of the early correspondence that you had. These are men who were either had, you know, cut their teeth in war correspondence, they had served time in foreign, you know, locations, et cetera. These men knew what they were talking about as well as just reading it, you know?
I'm
rambling again. But,
no, that's right. Even beyond that, we have some extremely good communicators on both the left and the right, actors and singers, like Tom Selleck, who's conservative, or Barbara Streisand, who's liberal. And if you listen to them, they make great presentations. And I don't think people go beyond that and say, well, wait a minute, this guy's a great actor or she's a great singer. Do they really know what they're talking about politics? You know?
Yes. Yeah, and I heard a story. I don't know this for a fact, but I heard a story where Barbara Streisand gave some sort of a presentation, I want to say at one of the Ivy League schools, and I guess by mistake they opened it up to questions thereafter. It readily became apparent that she really didn't have a grasp on what she had given a speech on. And I think, you know, a lot of the actors on the right and left would fall into that category because they don't really have a grasp on it. And that's unfortunate. I have friends on the right who constantly send out things on the Internet, et cetera, that are flawed factually, and I jump on their case. I said, you know, if you're going to argue these points, argue them with facts. Don't, as you put in your thing, you know, you can't change what you're quoting Moynihan, and I love it, you know, we can't change the facts. But they do. And how many times have you seen that thing, you know, we should pass a law where Congress has to pay for their own health insurance and they have to get on Social Security and they don't get retirement, full retirement after 2 years? Well, all three of those things are factually incorrect.
Okay. Right, I know that. Yeah.
but try telling that to 99% of the people who keep getting, and they keep circulating this stuff. And, I mean, that's just a blatant example of one thing. I mean, there's a whole bunch of others like that. But I don't know. I don't know, John. I don't know what the heck the answers are.
If you want to work at getting your views out, how are you going to do it? Are you going to write or are you going to run for office? What are you going to do?
No, I'm too old to run for office. Besides, I've long since concluded that most of my jobs, if you look back at the most of the, I was, somebody once labeled me, I was the gunslinger. When it got nasty in the litigation, you know, civil or criminal, et cetera, they'd knock on my dog and sort of like, you know, okay, it's time to release the pit bull, you know. I couldn't get elected dog catcher, John. I mean, I'll give you an example. Many of the young fellows, young attorneys, gals, and fellas who want to become judges or whatever have asked me on various occasions for recommendations, and I always say, sure. But you have to understand that if it goes before the right people, it may help you. On the other hand, I left a lot of bloody bodies across the years too, so I don't think I could get elected anything. But I may check up the writing venue, John. That I may do for sure.
A mutual friend of ours, Terry Shagroom, when he heard you were going on the show, told me how much you impressed them both and your writings and on the Inuit group than at our extended luncheon a few years ago. And he ended by saying that he was so impressed by your humility. The audience should know that Terry's analysis was borne out by the ending of your note with your bio to me. And I quote, "I hope there is enough interest in the above to merit the time on your show. If after reading my vitae, you don't believe that there is enough, please do not hesitate to delete my appearance. I promise my feelings will not be hurt." I'm sure the audience will agree that the review of your career was extremely interesting. And I know we didn't go into some detail that your experience warranted. Is there anything else that you'd like the audience to know about you?
Just one comment on that last comment. I was given a speech someplace. Don't ask me where. It's been too many years, John. And as I was standing in the back, you know, ready to walk up front because there was no area to sit up at the front there. And they went through these various things. And I have to admit that, you know, they were doing such a good job that, you know, my head was beginning to swell a little bit. And I heard the two young ladies were sitting in front of me, actually. They were middle-aged ladies. But one leaned over to the other after they went on with this for more than a few minutes and said, "What's the problem? Can he keep a job?" So I've never been overly impressed ever since then. That's all, John. I don't have anything else.
Is there anything else you'd want the audience to know about Jim Caulfield?
No, John, that's about it. There's no vast secrets that I know of.
Then thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, John. I totally appreciated it. You have a great show. Bye-bye.
And in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose after a Met game, put it in the book. Tune in next week for my conversation with writer Stan Grabowski. Until then, as I used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya.